in India after the country's Supreme Court rejected the petition seeking halt on the deportation process. The court in its ruling said the deportation process could go ahead as long as the government follows due process. Now more panic has gripped the community as their last hope seems lost. Experts say the Supreme Court ruling will give a sense of relief to the community for a while from being deported instantly. They, however, believe the ruling doesn't stop the detention process. Rather, it gives government more freedom to act swiftly. Legal experts are shocked about the judgment, saying the country has welcomed refugees from several countries since decades, but adopted a hostile approach towards Rohingya in particular. India has no legislation on the refugees, and it considers Rohingya as illegal immigrants and a threat to national security.
They can be deported in accordance with the law. Now, which law? Law, according to the government, means the Foreigners Act. Now, Foreigners Act doesn't deal with refugees. Refugees are a different category of people. We had argued that even non-citizens, even refugees, have Article 21 rights, the right to life.
In recent weeks, dozens or more refugees were detained from New Delhi. The police maintains they have orders from higher authorities to carry detention process. Now grief has befallen the destitute community. Rights activists say treating these refugees differently is a blow on India's ethos of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which means the world is one family.
Why is it not our concern if there are refugees coming from there? It's not just the refugee law. There are so many laws dealing with the rights of children, the Human Rights Convention, the Civil and Political Rights Convention. They all talk about the principle of non-refoulement, which means that you cannot send somebody to a country or outside your territory where there will be danger to his life or limb.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have risen since the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of BJP in 2014. Since then, many anti-Rohingya campaigns and Hindu groups have been demanding their expulsion. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
As the fourth wave of the coronavirus hits Iran, the country goes under another nationwide lockdown. From Saturday on, for at least 10 days, travel to and from high-risk cities will be banned, and non-essential businesses have to roll down their shutters. Schools, entertainment centers, and all public places will also be closed. Officials have avoided a total lockdown in Tehran, arguing that the capital city accommodates major national and international activities. The closures come amid a new wave of infections across Iran, which is believed to be the UK variant of COVID-19. Entering the country from neighboring Iraq.
The first reason why our hospitals are once again overwhelmed with COVID-19 patients is the fact that British variant of the virus slipped into our country through our Khuzestan and Iran borders with Iraq. Now we are unfortunately faced with a fourth wave of the pandemic.
Authorities blame the new spike on the two-week traveling spree during the Persian New Year holidays, which started on March 21st. The number of confirmed coronavirus cases in Iran has passed the 2 million mark, and the total fatalities have surpassed 64,000. Vaccination of the most vulnerable groups of the society is underway in Iran with Russian-made Sputnik V vaccine. But the country is yet to launch a nationwide vaccination program. The government hopes to kickstart mass inoculation in 2 months, using its own homegrown jabs.
While vaccines have also come in the ring to join the fight against COVID-19, the virus is still hard to knock out. Health officials advise everyone to take the new restrictions seriously. As they say, chances of survival are much lower for those who get infected with the UK variant of the coronavirus. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Dates, one of the fruits of paradise in Islamic tradition. With their paper-thin skin and juicy, sweet flesh, they have pride of place, especially on Muslim dinner tables.
Walk into any halal shop or indeed any supermarket here in the UK and you're bound to see dates on display. They come from many different places, including from Palestinian territories. And during Ramadan, they simply fly off the shelf. But could the Muslims living here in Britain, by taking dates to break their fast during the holy month, be unknowingly supporting the brutal Israeli occupation of Palestinians?
We put that question to the head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, an NGO running a campaign to boycott Israeli dates in the UK, now Israel's third target market.
They were breaking their fast on a date which is being grown on stolen land, which is actually even unlawful, to break your fast with something which is haram.
Israel is one of the world's top five exporters of dates. In 2018, the UK was Israel's largest market for dates worth more than $25 million. Over half of those are grown in illegal settlements, ruled by the United Nations, the International Court of Justice, and several other international organizations as illegal and built on stolen Palestinian land. Not only that, Israeli settlers are set to employ low-paid Palestinian laborers, among them children, to do the back-breaking job of picking the dates. But how are Muslims and non-Muslim Palestinian rights activists to ensure that the dates they're eating are not from the illegal Israeli settlements?
Israelis, instead of coming out and saying product of Israel, they are hiding the identity of the dates. Packages like this, you know, Al-Malik, you know, a Muslim name, Arabic writing, product of Palestine. But when you look, you realize it's a con, because there is no company importer or distributor attached to this.
This year's call to boycott Israeli dates subscribes to the mission of the Global Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement that works to end international support for Israel's oppression of Palestinians and pressure Israel to comply with international law.
We were in Britain number one importer of Israeli dates. Last year we informed everyone that we have become second, and this year we have become third. And at the same time, Palestinian dates are being supported and imported more.
This Ramadan, when Muslims in Britain break their fast with dates, they'll be wise to ask themselves if the dates they're eating are helping ease the suffering of Palestinians, or are they going towards oppressing them? Saeed Purza, London.
A shock end to the week as British royal Prince Philip, the husband of Queen Elizabeth II, was pronounced dead on Friday. Just hours after the news broke, mourners began gathering to lay flowers for the late Duke of Edinburgh, who was the longest-serving consort in British history.
Following the death of such a prominent member of the royal family, British media, particularly the BBC, appear to have gone into whitewash overdrive, portraying the prince as some kind of charitable war hero, whilst totally glossing over his various disgraces, including his numerous racist outbursts and his support for colonialism.
Both headlines and government statements were awash with complimentary tributes. But British social media reacted very differently, with Black and Irish Twitter hashtags going viral, two groups competing to mock the royals' scandal-ridden legacy.
His record is incredibly checkered. He has indulged in numerous racist outbursts, and has indeed been a champion of British colonialism.
He said, for instance, back in 2002, a group of Indigenous Australians on a visit to see them with the Queen, he asked them, do you still throw spears at each other?
The British monarchy represents everything bad in their history, and so quite understandably, they have a different viewpoint on his death and what it means.
He said, if you stay here much longer, you will all be slitty-eyed. That's what he told British exchange students who lived in Xi'an in 1986.
The prince had a bad habit of offending minorities, but also represented detested British imperialist values.
If we're going to swear an oath of allegiance to anybody, it should be an oath of allegiance to the people that elect us. We're all living in a democracy. We shouldn't be swearing an oath of allegiance, it seems to me, to a unelected monarchy.
150,000 COVID dead, 10 years of austerity, 120,000 of the most vulnerable and poor people dead. That's who I shed a tear from.
But now the flag at the palace has been lowered, and on Monday Parliament will honour the Duke with further tributes. But no matter how hard the establishment ignore it, the British royal legacy is tarnished. Robert Carter, London.
A joint commission session between Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA comes to an end in Vienna. Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says Iran's demand is clear. It would only come back to full compliance with the agreement after the U.S. lifts sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled following the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA. And Iran will also want to verify the sanctions lifting.
What we mean by verification is to see the effects of sanctions lifting in practice. So it is not enough for the U.S. to sign, you know, waivers or, I don't know, executive orders, whatever. Yes, they have to officially sign, but what matters for us is to see the effect of sanction lifting on the ground.
China's representative said the sides are narrowing down their differences. He said Beijing believes all the nuclear-related unilateral U.S. sanctions are illegal and should be lifted immediately to safeguard the JCPOA. The demand to lift all sanctions at once is a legitimate one, he said.
We think it's legitimate for them to lift it all at once, and it's an important issue.
But will they do it?
They have undertaken to do it. But we say that they must put it into action, turn their commitments into action.
Araghchi said he believes it is possible to get the job done sooner rather than later, but it depends on how willing and serious the other side is. After 3 days of intensive discussions within two working groups, the delegates agreed the talks are moving in the right direction. The Joint Commission will meet again on Wednesday amid hopes to maintain momentum. Homa Leski, Vienna.
Turkey has reported an unprecedented surge of daily coronavirus cases. The new infections stood at almost 55,000 on Wednesday, as the highest in the country since the outbreak of the pandemic last year. Turkish government plans to reduce the numbers during the upcoming holy month of Ramadan to welcome tourists again after the month. Turkish president said that he wants to see a significant reduction in the number of coronavirus infections by the end of Ramadan, as he announced last week that during the holy month, restaurants and coffee shops' work will be limited to takeout and delivery services only. Meanwhile, Turkey will continue to witness a daily curfew from 9 p.m. till 5 a.m. and total weekend lockdowns.
We aim to give a rest to our country during Ramadan and prepare it for better days after the Eid. If we could decrease the number of the cases to thousands, we will be able to catch the tourism season that is understood to be opened in May and the commercial activity that will be created by the tourism season.
Turkish Health Minister Fahrettin Koca said earlier that 75% of the new coronavirus cases in the country are from the more contagious variant detected in Britain. This as the country is still open for tourists who are not included in the curfew and lockdown measures. Some analysts believe the latest measures is the reason behind the sudden increase in the new cases.
We expected to see a spread of the virus amid the third wave. However, we didn't expect to see such high numbers, especially after we began public vaccination. Turkish government's trying to create a balance between people's health and economy. That's why it's trying to implement measures to contain the spread of the virus until at least 60% of the country is vaccinated.
Turkey is pressing ahead with its nationwide vaccination campaign using the Sinovac and Pfizer-BioNTech's vaccine shots. So far, more than 10.55 million people have been given the first doses and 7.41 million were given the second. Turkey's announcement of a nationwide lockdown during the holy month of Ramadan has created chaos, which is seen by many as the reason behind the increasing number of daily infections. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Since Joe Biden took office in the U.S., relations between Washington and Moscow have only spiraled downwards. The Biden administration has signaled a more confrontational approach towards Russia. It has already hit Moscow with economic sanctions over the jailing of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Washington has also threatened unspecified action over an alleged massive cyber attack, which it blames on Russia. Tensions have risen particularly after Biden publicly stated that he thinks Putin is a killer. Now, the Russian government says it will respond in kind to any new U.S. sanctions amid reports that the White House is about to announce further bans against Russia. This time, the source of tensions is the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Over the past 2 weeks, mainstream Western media outlets have been reporting about an increase in Russia's military presence along its borders with Ukraine. This coincides with reports of renewed clashes between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian forces in eastern Ukraine, leaving a ceasefire in the region effectively dead. Ukraine, the US and NATO accuse Russia of sending troops and heavy weaponry to prop up militias in the region. But the Kremlin says there is nothing to fear, describing the repositioning of Russian armed units as a domestic issue. Analysts believe Russia's military buildup along the border with Ukraine is a response to Kiev's saber-rattling.
This buildup of Russian troops is actually, to the contrary, it is in response to saber-rattling by Ukraine that is being instigated by the United States and in the form of NATO.
The notion that Russia is responding to Ukraine's escalation does not seem far from reality. Some observers believe Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who is in a weak position at home, is playing the anti-Russian card to appease the nationalist population and mobilize support in the West. They cite a recent crackdown on pro-Russia media and figures, as well as Zelensky's public call on NATO to speed up Ukraine's membership plan. The Kremlin, which has repeatedly voiced concern over NATO's eastward expansion, bitterly opposes the notion that Ukraine could someday join the Western military alliance. After all, Biden has been one of Kiev's staunchest supporters since before the outbreak of the conflict in eastern Ukraine in 2014. This week, Biden himself pledged unwavering support to the Ukrainian government. It remains to be seen how far the new U.S. administration is ready to go in its confrontational path on Russia. If the current trajectory continues, soon we will see a full-scale war of sanctions between the two governments at the least.
World Health Day is celebrated on the 7th of April every year. For 2021, the theme is Building a Fair, Healthier World. For Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, health inequities are an everyday reality that is rooted in Israel's long-held apartheid regime. Tel Aviv has waged three wars on the blockaded enclave and maintains a crippling blockade on it since 2007. During the 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces attacked 17 hospitals and 56 health centers. The Israeli regime's inhumane practices have led to a state of de-development within Gaza's healthcare system, making it extremely hard for health workers to combat the coronavirus pandemic.
The Israeli blockade in place over the past 14 years has battered the entire health system in the Gaza Strip. Hospitals and medical centers suffer from acute shortages in medicines and medical equipment, especially amid the rapid spread of the coronavirus pandemic.
This year's World Health Day comes amid a surge in coronavirus infections in the Gaza Strip. Despite the increasing number of coronavirus infections in the impoverished enclave, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment.
On this day, we confirmed that the epidemiological situation in the Gaza Strip is very dangerous, and the curve of infections continues to increase. Everyone must take the necessary measures to safeguard their families. We also call on all concerned local and international parties to help us in fighting the pandemic.
Under international laws and norms, the Israeli regime must ensure medical supplies to Palestinians, including combating the spread of pandemics. Experts warn that the health sector in Gaza could soon collapse unless serious steps are made to remedy the situation. On World Health Day, the regime's blockade continues to undermine efforts by health workers in Gaza
to provide proper medical care. This is while the situation has worsened in the besieged enclave due to the coronavirus pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything? Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Well, the Good Friday Agreement brought to an end years of bloodshed between Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland. After decades of calm, 23 years later, ironically, on Good Friday of this year, the situation imploded and clashes have taken place. How volatile is this situation, and how much of it is London to be blamed for? Stay with us as we take a look at the latest out of Northern Ireland on this debate. Well, I'd like to start it all off in London with Amina Taylor. Amina, fill us in on this latest situation that is taking place in Northern Ireland.
Marzia, it's almost ironic here that you come to me in London first, because there are many of those historians and political observers alike who will say the issues, regardless of their complexities, are pretty much the result of British interference in the Ireland of Ireland. And now we see for over a week now, on consecutive evenings, as dusk draws closer, that there will be the threat, the ever-looming threat of sporadic and escalating violence breaking out in different parts. Now, the last flashpoint was Tiger Bay, a loyalist area where the police came under attack. We're used to perhaps hearing about other communities in Belfast and so on. And we're now dealing with a very important role that Westminster has to play, and where Boris Johnson is with perhaps some of his advisors might be giving him information that's not quite correct, because the idea here that he's resisting calls from Simon Coveney, who is the foreign minister for the Republic of Ireland, to hold a summit on the escalation, because it would be seen as perhaps blowing the issue out of proportion. Well, when scores of police officers have been injured, when dozens of demonstrators have been arrested, and there is the fear that the Good Friday Agreement itself could be undermined, I think it's time for London to act. Now, on Thursday, Westminster sent Brendan Lewis, who is the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, and as my guest on that occasion said to me, they take with a pinch of salt what representatives from Westminster say, because it's the Northern Ireland Assembly that's supposed to be running its business. And because of the death of the Duke of Edinburgh, there wasn't a statement after that meeting. So we don't know what was agreed to and if that could have some traction. But I think the fact that violence has persisted after those high-level talks between Brendan Lewis and those five members of the Northern Ireland Executive gives us some indication, Marzia, that this situation, if not handled deftly, will continue to escalate, and no one wants to see a return to the bad old days, Marzia, no one.
Right, indeed. Thanks so much for that update. Amina Taylor out of London. Well, let's cross over now to Belfast. I'd like to welcome Andre Murphy, Irish journalist and political commentator, to the program. Thanks so much for being with us. Your take on the crux of the problem right now that we're seeing, this tension in Northern Ireland.
Thanks so much for having me. And I think that Amina summed up very much of it in terms of the broad sweep of issues. For, you know, if we're going to look at what's happening now, we have to look at England and Wales's vote to Brexit, which was against the democratic wishes of the north of Ireland. The entire population here overwhelmingly voted to remain in the EU. And that changed the political environment here, so that you see that there's demographic changes in terms of the north. So you're seeing more Catholics, nationalists now, nearly, fairly much half, could after the next census be in the majority, and they traditionally identify as Irish. You see that there is a growing conversation for a new constitutional arrangement on the island of Ireland, so calls for a border poll and calls for Irish unity and what form that may take. You see that Brexit is having a disastrous impact on the Good Friday Agreement, on our peace agreement, and that London really hasn't cared about that. So London pursued its own form of hard Brexit, completely impervious to the standing of the peace agreement and how that would impact this island. And that has left unionism on this island very much isolated. So they've handled Brexit incredibly badly. They supported the vote for Brexit, despite the democratic wishes of the people here. They supported a hard Brexit, despite it being very clear it was going to have a huge impact on the island of Ireland. And then you saw this large and ever-growing conversation for a united Ireland, and they haven't been able to meet it at all. They don't have a strong argument to stay in the union. So that insecurity has been manipulated and turned into some sort of argument that unionism is being oppressed or left behind, rather than the truth of the matter, which is that unionism needs to engage in these conversations in a more proactive way. And so you have all this false narrative, almost Trumpian narrative, that loyalism is in some way being left behind, that unionism is being left behind, okay, that their culture is under attack, that Catholics, nationalists and Republicans are doing really well. All of those things aren't true, but still it's taken a currency. And all of that leads to the traditional route where, so to speak, where the British government starts talking to militant paramilitaries in the loyalist groupings. So the representatives of the British government were talking to them since Christmas. So was the largest party here, the Democratic Unionist Party, as have the police service, talking to militant loyalism, who then start issuing their own statements of concern about their culture and identity and that they won't stand idly by. And then all of a sudden, young, and I mean very young, 13, 14-year-old loyalists start going out on the streets and start engaging in criminal behaviour. Right. And this is kind of traditional, what you sadly have seen in the past, where, and it's called the orange card, that when unionism is under attack or they feel their constitutional position is in some way being compromised, then they will start using these militant tactics.
Okay, but stay with me, Andre. Let me get our next guest in this conversation. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist out of Bristol. Welcome to the program. Your take, I think you heard what Andre was talking about. How much of what we're seeing right now relates, you think, to Brexit? And if it relates to it, was it basically that the British politicians It was not important for them. They did not take a look at what a hard Brexit, the effect that it would have for Northern Ireland and Ireland in general?
Well, yes, it's all to do with Brexit, actually. And don't be fooled by my orange sweater here. I'm not an orange man or an orange supporter, which is the Orange Order, which is at the heart of the loyalist cause in Northern Ireland. And I did live right on the border between County Cavan and Fermanagh for a year or more, and I know the situation there pretty well. Yes, it's all to do with Brexit. And I think what's happened is the British government have just been browbeaten so much by the Irish Republicans in the north and obviously the south, which is still in the EU and still very pro-EU, plus Brussels, to create this kind of running sore. I mean, they had a choice about having a border. They could have had a border in the Irish Sea, or they could have had a border around Northern Ireland in between the north and the south. And they chose to have the border in the Irish Sea, which was always going to create problems for the future. Look, the British have, and this is the first time they've done this sort of thing, we've seen the same kind of things on the Arabian Peninsula around the time of the First World War, you know, creating the division between Saudi Arabia and Yemen, which is now a running sore, and the same sort of thing in Kashmir between India and Pakistan, are now still a running sore. And, of course, that's exactly what's going on in the north.
So, Tony, are you saying that London wants this division, wants to see these clashes? What are you saying?
Well, no, I don't think they necessarily want to see it, but they just couldn't be bothered with the issue when it came to the Brexit negotiations. And they really sold out the Northern Irish. And I think that is why the loyalists are so upset about this. Now, it's not fair to say that they're doing this just, you know, for the cameras or whatever. No, absolute nonsense. They've been quiet for a long time, and they've been trying to get something done about this, you know, actually wanting to be part of the United Kingdom. Really, the only thing to solve this now, I think, is to have a referendum right across the north on whether they want to have unification with the south. That would certainly clear things up as to where this border should be. But really, it's the usual fudging from Westminster and head-scratching, saying, oh, gosh, you know, this is too much of a problem for us over in London to sort out. And of course, that, I think, is, and it's a very, very long problem, this. It goes right the way back 350 or so years to the plantation of Ireland by Oliver Cromwell in the mid-1600s, when just after the English Civil War here in England, I suppose what you would call now the UK, because the Scots were involved a bit as well. So back in those days, there was a massive fight over in Ireland at the end of the English Civil War, and the winners were the Cromwellians, and they gave all the land, the good land in the north of Ireland, the good farming land, to the victors in that war. And there were two completely separate cultures. So you've got the Catholic culture generally in the south, and you've got the Protestant culture or Presbyterian culture in the north. Now, these people are not necessarily churchgoers, but they're part of a different culture. And this is what the seeds of the problems that kicked off in 1972 in Bloody Sunday, and the troubles in Northern Ireland, which happened in the latter part of the 20th century. But that was all sorted out, we thought, in 1998 with the Good Friday Agreement. Now, what's happening now, I think, is an attempt to sort of reopen those wounds. But it's something which, in a way, has been left by Boris Johnson and his chums, and particularly Theresa May, this whole backstop agreement thing, from the exiting the Brexit from the EU, that hasn't really been dealt with properly at all. And they need, I think, to have, it's obvious to me, they have to have some sort of border between the north and the south until there's a referendum. When I lived there back in the mid-1990s, there was a massive border. My goodness, if you wanted to get across that border, you had to wait about half an hour at an army checkpoint. I used to cycle across, and it was one of the most strictly policed borders in the whole of Europe. And so what we should have now, I think, is some kind of much lighter touch border with maybe a few spot checks, but there has to be some sort of border. We're talking now about inside and outside the EU, and mm-hmm. I don't think it's possible to have a country like Ireland with some part of it in the EU, another part of it out, without a border. And that's the fudge that Boris and Theresa May have left for this present generation.
Okay. Well, Andre, the EU Commission recently closed the border between Northern Ireland and Ireland due to trying to even control vaccines being sent to the UK. This was done briefly, but it was enough to upset some people there in Ireland that if the EU wanted to do it, it could close the border at any time. How do you see this affecting the whole as far as what is going on? And many say just an overall lack of consideration that has come out of London.
I mean, there's no doubt that London doesn't care. You know, none of their negotiations, their thoughts about Brexit, what they wanted to do, gave a second thought to the north of Ireland. I think if they were asked in the morning, and, you know, George Osborne has referred to this, if they were asked in the morning, they would get rid of the north of Ireland if they thought they could get away with it politically. There's no two. And I think that unionism has recognised that, and there's a real sense of abandonment around that. This year doesn't only mark the anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, it's also the 100th anniversary of partition, where an artificial line was drawn on this country, and it's been upheld by violence ever since. And that border is, you know, has been upheld through murder, it's been upheld through the promotion of violence and the threat of violence. I think that the Good Friday Agreement, when it came along, was a settlement, a constitutional settlement between the two governments and between all of the parties, that everything would be resolved peacefully in the future. And a core part of that was to recognise that the citizens living on the island could, when the conditions were right, make a decision about their constitutional future. So a border poll deciding whether the constitutional arrangement could change is absolutely on the table now as a result of England's decision to leave the EU. And, you know, the British government in particular has been incredibly sniffy and impervious to that general wave of conversation that's happening. They're refusing to countenance calling a date. They're refusing to engage in discussions around planning for such a poll. If there's one thing that we do know from Brexit is that if there's going to be a poll, it needs to be planned for. People know what they need, must know what they need to vote, be voting for, and especially what will happen to British citizens who live on this island. And right now, they are not engaging in that conversation. Unionism and loyalism is watching this conversation happening around them and about them, and not with them. And that is a huge, huge risk for them. And the British government owes them the opportunity to be engaged in constructive conversations about the constitutional future, which will involve relationships with Britain, which will involve British citizens living on this island and their rights. And so far, they're refusing to do it because they don't care. I think what's really important to recognise is that this policy of partition is undoubtedly a colonial policy that they used all through the 20th century, and Britain has yet to come to terms with their obligations as a result of those policies. So one of the factors that is absolutely creating some of the disquiet on the streets is how we deal with the past of our conflict. Right now, the British government is in default of all of its international legal obligations to victims of the conflict, no matter who affected them, whether it was the British state or non-state actors. And they are refusing point blank to put in place any investigations for those victims.
Okay.
And that's creating huge disquiet. And also, it's preventing the possibility and the potential for improved community relations, where we understand our past, where we recognise the hurts and harms that were inflicted on each other, and gives us the opportunity for reconciliation. That the British government is refusing to do that is because they don't want to be embarrassed about their role during the conflict. They don't want the truth about their collusion with loyalist paramilitaries in particular to come out.
Okay.
But what they're doing is they are preventing the opportunity for victims and survivors to have dignity as equal citizens in this on this island.
Stay
but
with
also
me, Andre.
Inter-community reconciliation.
Stay with me. Tony, your take. I mean, both of you have talked about the importance now of basically having a referendum there. And of course, Andre said that they do not talk about this and what it will take to calm the situation down, because she said that they don't care. Your take on it? I mean, if London, so far they're not talking about having a referendum there, I mean, where do you see this going?
Well, they're going to have to. I mean, they've done it in Scotland, and I think the best way to do referenda like this is to say, well, this is going to be your last chance for the next 20 years to make a decision. In Scotland, they made a decision fairly clearly. They wanted to stay within the union. And I think they're going to have to do something similar in the north of Ireland as well. But look, there's another side to all of this. Remember, the original uprising against the British Empire, which really was the death knell for the Empire, and it was about time too, many would say. I would agree, actually, was during the First World War in 1916, the Easter Rising. Easter is a very, very important time in Ireland, not only because there's a lot of people of the Christian faith there, but also because it's the anniversary of the rebellion of the Irish against London back in 1916. And this all kicked off around Easter time a week or so ago. This is, it's an important time of the year, and Irish people all over the island understand the significance of this time of year when they have tried and tried to get sensible policies through the political means, and they've failed. They've been stonewalled, they've been ignored, they've been insulted. It's time to go to the streets, and that's why I think they're doing this. Also, of course, one of the other things which has made things far, far worse, particularly for young people, is all the COVID restrictions that have been around for the last year too. Young people have had enough of all of this. It's like a pressure cooker. They have been told all the time to stay indoors. The police are approaching them, threatening to fine them, prosecute them, even arresting them if they're gathering in the streets and just having a chat with their friends. And I noticed today, the guy's name, I think, is Mark Hinsey or something. He's the chair of the Police Federation of Northern Ireland for the Northern Ireland Police Force. That is representing, it's kind of like a trade union, representing the rank and file officers, saying that the COVID regulations have made things far, far worse for the police, and also they've broken down trust between the communities and the police. Now, this is a powder keg in Northern Ireland. You cannot do this sort of thing. So the COVID regulations have made things extremely difficult for the police to actually be trusted by the communities. And this is the rank and file police officers themselves saying this. So we need to make sure that that there are better facilities for youngsters. For example, all the youth centres have been closed down, and they're demanding now that they reopen them because the young people need to have something to do.
Stay with me, Tony. I only have a minute. Andre, your perspective. What is it going to take to de-escalate the situation there?
Well, I think that that Britain needs to stop pretending that it's neutral and wringing its hands, recognise its obligations, and I think that the idea of a summit that Amina referred to is absolutely essential. All the parties in both governments need to get back around the table, talk about what's outstanding from the Good Friday Agreement and the Stormont House Agreement, and start meeting those obligations. There's legal obligations here, including the holding of the border poll, and that is a significant part of the Good Friday Agreement, and it needs to be planned for.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us, Andre Murphy, Irish journalist and political commentator out of Belfast, and Tony Gosling, investigative journalist out of Bristol. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello. I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. if you happen to visit a carpet market ever in your life, surely you will become excited by seeing a world of design, color, and beauty. Seeing all those beauties and art encourages everyone to choose a beautiful carpet to buy. Iranian carpet is one of the most popular carpets in the world and enjoys a high level of popularity and fame. Today I have come to Kerman, a city in the center of Iran where its carpets have international fame. Carpets and the activity of weaving carpets mainly originate in Asia. Researchers say Iran, Turkestan, and Caucasus are the cradle of the art of carpet weaving. Also in the countries like Turkey, Spain, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Egypt, China, and even in the Balkans, the carpet industry and the art of carpet weaving has been common, and people of these regions are active in this field. According to studies, the first carpet in the world is an Iranian rug called Pazirik. This rug was discovered in 1949 by a team of Russian archaeologists in the excavations in Altai region in southern Siberia, in a valley by the same name of Pazirik. Researchers believe Pazirik dates back to the era of Parthians or the Medes during the Achaemenid Empire. Right now, I am in a carpet weaving workshop. A group of women are weaving a beautiful carpet while their cute kids are busy playing. These ladies recite the number and color of the knots they're weaving vociferously and in a rhythmic tone. So, by this way, their activity gets a type of order and makes them do their job with more carefulness. How soothing is the sound of carpet weaving! The carpet comb is a tool with metal dents which are placed in orderly spaces. The handle of the comb can be wooden or metal. The comb weighs around 0.5 kilograms. After weaving a row, the carpet weaver pushes down on the weft so that the warp and weft are pressed firmly. After weaving several rows, the weaver cuts off the long lengths with big special scissors. The Iranian carpet is the most beautiful handicrafts in the world indeed. I never knew the old red rug which I have inherited from my grandmother and tread on it every day, fancy-free, has so much effort behind it. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Good morning!
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.